everywhere. The shiny look in the summer fingers. Gonna find a thing in the balloons. It's a cube. People pushing men and modern. People pushing men and modern. Grabbing people back to reach. And people in the box of trees. Now I got these splitting headaches. Get quiet, get it up no more. I can't sleep, but it's driving me crazy. Shake all the MC double. Keep on voicing men are modern. 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 Keep on voicing men are modern.
All right, welcome to Orphan Radio. This is Matt. My guest today is Patrick O'Neill. We're going to talk about his book, Anarchy at the Circle K, and some of his other writings and about his life and background as well. Let's go back to the beginning of when you first got into the punk scene. Can you talk about, you were living in San Francisco at the time, right?
Yeah, I was living in San Francisco. I was going to the San Francisco Art Institute. I was kind of a rocker kid. I had long hair, listened to Johnny Winters. And a friend of mine said, come down to this club, the Blue Hit Gardens, and I saw a band DOA play. And it blew my mind. Because, you know, I think week before I'd seen something like, I forget who it was, or it was like Judas Priest, something like that, at the Cow Palace, which was another big, huge venue in San Francisco, arena, you know, and it was like massive, and you couldn't get near the band. At the MAB, Joey Shithead from DOA was 2 inches away from me. The band was playing. It was like this tight, heavy energy. And like a week later, I cut my hair. That was it, man. Saw the Ramones a week after that.
What year are we talking for that?
That would be 79.
Okay. And how did you start working for bands?
Well, I got hooked up in the whole punk scene and started working at that club, the Blue Hit Gardens, and the club upstairs from it, which is called the On Broadway. And a friend of mine was the sound man for both clubs, and his name was Chris Grayson. And he did tours with the Kennedys and TSOL. And there was another roadie, and there was a couple of road managers, stuff like that. And the other roadie stopped working. I got offered the job, just like, do you want to come on tour? And I had been working stage and working in back door and stuff like that, but I had never been on tour. And then so I started doing local shows with the Kennedys, where I started doing. And then my first tour was with TSOL.
Okay. For somebody who's my age, you didn't get to see Dead Kennedys. Can you talk about their live performance a little bit? Because I've seen video, but obviously not the real thing.
Well, I mean, it was an intense time. It was like, I think it's the heyday of hardcore, but, you know, I was in it. So I'm just the old guy shaking his fist at young kids, you know, but it was like, it was like when it was sort of like, it was new, it was fresh, it was happening. You got to remember that, like, you know, it was sort of a disenfranchised time. It was Reagan. It was roughly politically like it is now. It was a little crazy. Kids were pretty, you know, not happy with what was going on in the world. And so our shows would be, you know, all these young guys and coming down who are disenfranchised with the world, and the Kennedys would play right into that. And to be fair, half the audience was there to hate us, half the audience was there to like us, and it was just mayhem. And the punk was total mayhem there. The thing on, you know, Ben had stage diving, that happened, and, you know, there was just a sea of bodies. It was just insane. And the Kennedys are a strong band. They were really, really could rout the crowd. Jello was a real performer, and you know, he talked a lot, and he riled people up. They either hated him or liked him, and so our shows were always a spectacle. Plus, you know, come on, the name Dead Kennedys is going to start some kind of controversy somewhere. There was towns we couldn't play in because of that.
Yeah, and so the first band you actually went out on tour with was TSOL. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And then when you were on the road with the Dead Kennedys, it's hard to imagine touring in the 1980s with no cell phones, no internet, you know. So And especially, I was thinking about this too, like touring in the South and rural areas. You said like one of the things you guys always said was don't get off the interstate. But what was it like touring in, you know, places like Louisiana, North Carolina, and places like that back then?
Well, it was rough, man. I mean, you know, I mean, we obviously looked different. Plus, we were northern people anyway. You know, looking from San Francisco and New York, that kind of thing. So there was this weird thing, like some people wanted to know for like they weren't sure for the next Beatles or Stones or something like that. They were impressed by it, but they still was at a distance. And then there was abject hatred towards us. And we looked different, you know. DH was it was black, the drummer for Dead Kennedys, a lot of hatred towards that, you know. And then we were traveling through towns where the cops weren't exactly warm and inviting, and you know, a lot of our shows got shut down. The problem was that we were getting too big in the last couple of tours, and what it was like was that there would be 3,000 people in the hall and 3,000 people outside the hall, and didn't like that, you know. And we were having a hard time jumping into the next level. There was infighting in the band about going to the next level because I was kind of like selling out. The other side of the band really wanted to get to the next level, a little bit safer for the client, for the clients, sorry about that, for the people in the shows and stuff like that. So we you know, it was just become one of those times. But you know, again, the name was a problem. You know, we looked totally different. You know, I was a drug addict. Half the road crew was drug addicts. The band, not so much. There was a lot of problems. You know, there was a lot of stuff going on. A few tours involved with drugs and guns, and you know, we were everything the cops were afraid of.
Yeah. Do you now you mentioned it for a second, but you developed a pretty bad heroin problem. You talk about it a lot in the book. How do you keep it together to, you know, get the show off the ground every night? And I'm assuming you guys were out for like what, 2 or 3 months at a time?
Well, I mean, we'd always take, well, me, and if it was just me, if there was the drug addict, or if it was a few of us other drug addicts, you know. In the end, I hired my girlfriend and sound man, and all these people around me were drug addicts. The whole crew was drug addicts for the Kennedys, and the Kennedys didn't know it, or they didn't really make a thing out of it. And we would take a pile of drugs with them, but it's going to last a month, and it would last a week, you know. And then we'd be hustling and trying to find drugs in America, you know. And I think it's, you can find drugs in every major city in America. You just got to know how to do it. Became very adept at that, you know. But I mean, I was young, you know. I think you can be pretty resilient. And it was it, for one, you got to look at this one thing. We get itineraries where it would be, you know, L.A., Denver, Portland, you know, Salt Lake, and Chicago in the first week, you know. And you know, no one's gonna be able to drive that without drugs. You know, it's
Yeah.
just not happening, man. And so we, it's a young man's game, right? So part of it was just, you know, being able to do the job and get out there. There's a lot of heroin, a lot of meth, a lot of stuff like that, you know, just you know. And plus it was a lot of hard drinking, like there's a lot of alcohol. And so it just was part of the whole thing. But it was, we did our jobs, you know. I was good at my job.
Jelly Biafra. It seems like he, in, at least from the book, like you guys weren't like the best of friends. Did you get along with him well? What kind of guy was he?
You know, Biafra's a hard guy to get along with. You know, I don't think we're not friends. I you know, it was a definitely it was definitely just, you know, boss and higher, you know, person working for him. You know, he takes a lot. He's a lot of maintenance, you know. And but we got along fine. You know, I had a lot of arguments with him. I tried to write that as what's the right word? You know, I don't want to. I don't want to. I don't want to be. I don't want to come as a grudge. I don't have a grudge against him. So we had some problems sometimes, and then we didn't. And you know, but I worked with Biafra for, you know, geez, like 6, 7 years. You
Yeah.
know, if it wasn't horrible, I wouldn't have done
Right.
it. And I'd be like, man, the other guys in the band were really amazing, and I was very close to the other guys in the band. You know, so it was cool. They treated their crew like family. You know, most of them.
Yeah. Some of those you mentioned Mabuhay Gardens and some of those kind of classic venues that aren't around anymore. What are some of the other ones that come to mind? Like is City Gardens and Trenton?
Yep, City Gardens and Trenton. Let me think. I just what else is happening? Well, there's a ton of them down here in L.A. The Starlight's gone. A whole bunch of clubs here. Sam's Club, all this stuff's gone. The cafe. All this stuff's gone. I wouldn't know really what else in the world is gone. But I would just assume they're not. I don't know if the Rat's still there in Boston. I
I
have
think
no
that's
idea.
gone too.
Yeah, I think all that stuff's gone. I mean, that whole mode of touring is non-existent. There was a whole, a whole. We created our own system, our own people. That was word of mouth and with telephone and like usually pay phone, and it was put together that kind of thing. So those clubs were really independent, but now nothing's independent anymore. Clear Light and Live Nation and all that stuff owns everything,
Right.
and it becomes a corporate thing. The one thing we didn't do was corporate. We couldn't deal with corporate. That was the whole thing. That's why the Kennys put together Alternative Tentacles, put their own records out. There was a whole thing about, punk was, and this started before Crass, but Crass really pushed it, was, not to sell out, not to be part of the system, to be your own thing. And we hit towns like in the middle of nowhere, of Kamloops up in Canada or someplace in West Virginia. And it'd be this tiny little VFW hall with this kid promoter, and there'd be a PA, and we'd be playing. And I'd look around and go, nobody's coming to the show tonight. And 4,000 kids would show up out of nowhere. It was pretty amazing. There was another club that was really cool in New Jersey that was equal to the City Garden. It was called the Show Pass Showcase. And it was up in Dover, and it was a strip club during the day. It's in the book, the strip club during the day, and a music venue at night. That was a great club out in the middle of nowhere. It was pretty cool.
You talk about a bunch of different towns and cities, and there's one part of the book where you're in Lawrence, Kansas, and I used to live in Lawrence for a while, and I bet Dead Kennedys probably played a bigger place, but did you ever on tour stop at a place called the Outhouse in Lawrence, Kansas? It was kind of out in the middle of nowhere.
I don't think so. I don't
Okay.
know. Yeah. But Lawrence is great because it's a college town. You might have a bunch of whatever, things happen around it, but college towns always jump out. I mean, that's why Austin's good. There's a whole bunch of, every state's got one city that's at least open to having alternative music come play at it.
Right. One another thing you talk about in the book, and it's almost myth at this point, but it's like the violence in the punk scene in the 80s. I'm sure you experienced a lot of that. Can you talk about that a little bit?
A lot of the young males were attracted to hardcore because, for one, it was very angsty. One, we could, it sort of hit the nail on the head for what people were feeling politically at that time. And on the other side of it, there was a bunch of political factions. There was a whole bunch of racist skinheads running around the country, usually a mob, sort of mob brat pack kind of scenes. There was, left wing factions. There was skaters. There was, all these different factions. And then when they would meet at the club at night, and there'd just be, full on kind of ongoing kind of violence. And it's you know it's, like, I don't want to say it promotes violence, but it the music was hardcore. That's what it was called. It was hardcore. It was pushing. The drive was heavy. Shows were fueled by alcohol and drugs. It got pretty insane, And yeah, it wasn't like go to a show now and there's 3 million security there either. There were, a couple of security guys. I worked stage a lot because somebody had to clear the stage and get up there. And it was pretty hard. It was hardcore. It was a lot of violence going on. At the same time, if you weren't involved in it, if you were in the background, if you were to hang out, it wasn't affected. You weren't affected, but you could look into the pit and see that. And the reality is, if you venture into the pit, you get what you get. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's been a couple books out too about the specifically the LA punk gang stuff. Did you ever have any, were there ever any shows that stick out where there was any of that, like Suicidal Tendencies gang and that kind of stuff?
I mean, I was on the inside, so I knew the guys in Suicidal and stuff like that. I mean, that was definitely there. The bigger shows like the Olympic and Perkins Palace, there'll be a lot of that happening out in the crowd and stuff like that. But I mean, I wasn't a warring faction with them. You know what I mean? So it wasn't like I ever had an issue with them. I was definitely not a gang member like that, and I wasn't part of that. But I got a pass. You know, it was like I was colleagues in the music industry or something like that. But it wasn't like Suicidal brought the gang stuff backstage and things like that. It was like out in the audience, you know.
Were shows in LA more insane than other cities, or was it all kind of bad?
Shows in LA were insane. They were huge. The Olympic was this old wrestling auditorium downtown. There'd be 40, there was not about 8,000 people, something like that, across the floor. It would just be this huge stage, people all over. They'd have a wall of people trying to get up on top of them. There would just be a huge pit. They were kind of scary, you know. I mean, not scary, scary, but I mean, if you were, you got to be on your toes. You got to see what's going on. You didn't know what's happening, especially working the stage. It was really tough because there's this really a lot of bright lights on stage and people are throwing things. And like, you know, you can't see it until it's 10 feet away from you materializing in the lights because the lights are so bright. And like, you know, so shoes are flying and beer cans are flying and stuff like that. And any big city, the shows are more amplified. New York had the same thing, that the World Theater and places like that. It was just huger, bigger crowds, and the level of violence, and not just violence, but the level of you know, the level of excitement was happening more. It was just a bigger thing, you know, and the bands could feel that and play that way.
Yeah. What year was the last time you were on the road?
Last time I was on the road with Kenny's was 87.
Okay. So that must have been that. So were they kind of falling apart at the end, or was their breakup sudden?
Oh, no, there was a lot of problems going on. The breakup was sudden in the way that we had a bunch of tours booked, Japan, Australia, a bunch of other stuff happening. And then I got the phone call from Ray that said the band's dissolved, we're done. And that was it. But it was ongoing already. The Kennedys flew and you know, it had separate arrangements to they didn't fly in the same plane. You know, there was just a lot of tension. There was a lot of deals of what the band wanted to do. Biafra's idea, Ray had his idea. It was just a lot of conflict like that. But it was the kind of thing that put aside and go out and play a show every night. You know, it wasn't like they were hating each other. They just had different ideals how to run the business.
Yeah. And how is being on the road with Flipper different than with Dead Kennedys? I'm imagining in every way.
Oh, absolutely. Flipper was its own animal. Here is the problem. The Kennedys weren't drug addicts. They had a few drinks and stuff like that. Flipper was all drug addicts. There was half, one side was meth heads and one side was heroin addicts. And I'm in the middle. And it was just me and them in a 1959 harvest, International Harvester bread truck driving across country with all the gear. We were out of our minds. We were crazy. It was a 3 month long tour with a 1 month hanging out in New York City. We were just crazy. It was a rough tour. It was a weird tour. There's a lot of infighting. A lot of members of the band didn't like each other. It was pretty rough, you know. And on top of it all, 3 months is a long tour. And Flipper was not like Dead Kennedys pulling in the kind of money that Dead Kennedys were. So a lot of the times we were really scraping it. There was resentments about me getting a salary while I was on the road with them, while they were kind of scraping it. And, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff there. Like, I got some in the book. There was a lot of infighting involved like that. Bruce, one of the lead singer bass players, just got up and left in the middle of the tour. We had to get somebody back out there. You know, there was gigs where I didn't know if we were going to get enough money at the gig to have great gas to the next stop. We were staying on people's floors. It was sort of like what was happening when I first started touring way back when, in 81, 82. And so it was a much rougher scene, you know, and it's smaller shows. And you know, Flipper is just really difficult.
You've written a couple other books too. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit, if you're okay with it, about you're pretty open about like how you, after you were off the road, you kind of turn to a life of crime in order to support your drug habit, robbing banks, things like that. And you ended up going to San Quentin for a little while. Is that right?
Yeah, that's okay. Right.
How long were you there for?
I only did 18 months to 2 years. I mean, I got sentenced to 4 years in prison, but I had already done 18 months in county fighting my case. They were trying to give me a three strikes case, which would have been 25 to life because of the number of armed robberies I did. But my lawyer got it down to two strikes, and I ended up going to San Quentin for the remainder of the 4 years, which was, good time. You know, not much good time with two strikes and a bunch of other stuff. Worked out for about 18 more months, and then I got out. So I did 18 months at San Quentin.
I mean, can you talk about that a little bit? Like, what's it like going in there for the first time? And I mean, can you just talk about it a little bit?
I was scared shitless. I was very scared, and here's the deal. I'd gone from being this art school kid involved with music, which was sort of, how I got into the Dead Kennedys, to, way past ever being anything to do with creativity or music or whatever. I like to say the only thing punk rock about me in those days was I had a leather jacket and maybe wore a lot of black. I'd been running the streets for 10 years, and I come from a good family. My dad was an MIT professor. I mean, I went downhill all the way you can with heroin. And so I was in the right, and this sounds weird, but I was in the right mind state to go to prison, because I could deal with it. And I was very street smart and I was there. But there's a definite jump from going from county jail to state prison because, it's a big time for criminals. And you roll up to this huge building that's made out of stone and there's barbed wire and concertina wire everywhere. And you're a fish, you're a new fish, and you come out and you're in a disposable uniform that's going to get tossed out before you get the blues. You're going to be wearing it for the time you're there. And you get put in an R&R, which is a release and relocation. And it's you go into a cell block for 23 hours a day. You're in your cell and you wait for classification. I was in that cell for like, I don't know, 60 days of my stay there. And you get a bag lunch every day. You get to go to the chow hall once in a while. You get a shower once a week. And the noise level in prison is unbelievable. It's just this din of people talking and shouting and yelling and metal on metal and cement on cement and loudspeakers going off and the clanging of bells and all stuff like that. It would drive anybody crazy, but it's just this level of tension. And the thing is, people talk about prison, everyone's like, it's so wild, it's crazy. The thing is, actually what happens is prison is incredibly boring with these punctuated by these intense moments of violence. And you never know when, you kind of know, but you never know when it's actually going to happen. Again, you got to keep your eyes open. And it's pretty insane. It's pretty insane. I was what, 4 years old when I got there. And I looked around. I was on the prison yard. I was 41. It was my birthday. I was on the prison yard. And I just looked around and go, how did this happen? How am I here? And I just made a vow this was not going to be what's going to happen to me the rest of my life. It was just not good, And there's nothing happens there that's any good. It's just, you're getting warehoused. You're getting warehoused the rest of your life there. I mean, it's prison. They make sure it's not going to be good. And it's pretty dismal. The people that like prison are institutionalized and they got to just, they've gotten used to that kind of thing. I didn't get used to it. I went out of there. I got out of there as soon as I could.
I mean, is it possible in a place like San Quentin to mind your own business and keep your head down and people leave you alone?
I did that. A place like San Quentin, especially because San Quentin's like a gateway to a bunch of northern prisons, and so people are transient all the time there. There's still gangs. There are gangs still running. Everything's happening. But the thing is, what I learned when I was in county was like I stopped doing drugs. I stopped doing all this other stuff like that. I got into recovery. And, I wasn't part of a mix. I wasn't like in the contraband. I wasn't buying drugs. I wasn't gambling. I wasn't paying for sex. I wasn't doing any of these kind of things happening there. And if I don't have anything to give them, if they don't want anything from me, if I have nothing to offer, then there's no reason to deal with me. I had a couple of guys try to take my commissary, got into a little problem with them and took care of it. It's the people you get tested or whatever you want to say is happening there. But I minded my own business. I got involved with a writing group and, went to AA and NA and just stayed out of the mix.
So was the specific charge you went to prison for, was it bank robbery?
It was they got plead down to robbery. So, but I mean, everyone knows what you're there for. I mean, there's a clerk in the county, in the warden's office that knows your charges, and it gets put out, everybody sort of knows. So I got a few counts of robbery, and then there's a bunch of other charges that didn't come through, but they're on my record. And so it was well known what I was there for. And here's the thing: I got put in a level 4 yard. The level 4 yard is, you know, it's not all your petty criminals and that kind of stuff. It's people there for murder, bigger things, right? And so it's a little bit calmer. It's a little bit easier to deal with. Don't get me wrong; it's a bad place to be, and people are hardcore. But if you're a level 4 because you're charged, you're in a better yard because there's more discipline. I don't know what else to really call it. You know, there's less. I mean, no one's stealing your stuff like in the lower yards where it's all shoplifters and drug addicts. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. Do you go back up to San Francisco very often? I know that was kind of your home base for a long time.
Yeah, I got family up there. My wife's family is from up in Marin, so we go up there often. I got good friends there. I mean, you know, after I got out, I did dirt for 25 years there, and then I stayed there for the first 10 years of my recovery. And so I got a lot of good people up there who are in recovery. I worked in two rehabs in the Bay Area. And I still have good memories of it. But I got high in every corner of LA. I mean, of San Francisco. You know, I moved to LA purely because financial. I mean, San Francisco is unaffordable to anybody that's not making, you know, six figures.
Right. And you're teaching now at a college, right?
I teach part time. I teach creative writing. I'm a glorified TA at another college where I just correct papers for an English class, and then I also I work at a rehab. I'm a drug and alcohol counselor at a rehab. So I have three jobs, you know, and I write on top of that.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. I really appreciate it, man. Let me know, and I'll pimp the hell out of it on social media, man.
Roaches up to my knees.